Okay, and welcome to the XRP Army News podcast for today. We have had the honor of having quite a few of the folks who are definitely influencing the information flow for XRP and the crypto community. And those people have shared with us very openly. And I know that you probably have enjoyed those discussions because although you listen to some of their YouTube broadcast and some of their YouTube information, sometimes you get a little extra hint of what's going on here. Now, today's interview is going to be with Cryptopolis. We'll call him David today, but Cryptopolis will be with us. And as some of you know, of course, he does the co-host with Brad Kimes on Friday and has much input to many other of the influencers pages, and he does influence the influencers. So besides being that, he is totally a data-driven person. So we're going to find a little bit about that data-driven person by introducing him right now. And boom, here we go. Hey, David, it's good to have you on today.
Well, it's good to be here, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're definitely impacted the marketplace because you dig deep down into some of the things that some of the others don't choose to. But before we start, I really do want to ask you, you know, where exactly do you live? And I don't want the address so anybody can sneak up behind you, but what state do you live in?
Well, I'm a permanent resident of New York State. I'm in central New York, not upstate, but central New York, which is near Syracuse. I have also a home in Washington, D.C. So I kind of spend my time between those two residences.
Okay. By having a home in Washington, D.C., does that mean you do some lobbying in some way? Or
No. I was in politics many, many years ago, but I left it. I was the director of economic development and then the deputy commissioner of urban and economic development for the city I lived in for a number of years. And I was a CEO of two not-for-profit corporations that did inner city housing. And I did that for about 15 years before I started my own business. But I don't like politics.
Being in urban development, you experience enough politics as being in there as you wanted, I'm sure. Do you have a family? Well, tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, I have a wife and four children. We have three boys and one girl. My oldest child is graduated from Trinity and Johns Hopkins University. My second oldest got his master's at Johns Hopkins as well. My third graduated from a school in Boston and now is living in Washington, D.C. and works for one of the largest luxury property managers, owners in the city of Washington. My daughter just graduated from American University in Washington, D.C. And she's now out in Seattle and looking to get into her professional life and career, and we've got a large four children, three boys, one girl, and it's been a long time since we've had babies in the house. But I am proud to say that I am now a grandfather three times over. We had our first grandchild about 4 years ago. In fact, she just had her birthday yesterday, or the 21st. Those and Thursday, I guess. And then we had two grandchildren born in March this year. So we're starting to grow quite rapidly. Four children, three grandchildren.
And you never know when they all actually come to your house. You're going to have quite the treat there, aren't you?
It's going to be something. It's a good thing we have a pretty large house. We had when the four kids were growing up, we moved from a smaller house to a larger house, and we've stayed in the larger house and done many renovations over the years. But we're still here. Hopefully, we'll fill it up with grandchildren and our children when they all come back.
I can't think of better decorations and decor than a bunch of grandkids running up and down the stairs, over the floors. That's wonderful. Congratulations, David, and to your family. That is fantastic stuff. It's a joy that some people don't appreciate quite as much as they should, without a doubt. Now, you have, with all your business background and what you were doing in your previous companies, was really, you had to kind of take a deep dive into a lot of economics and so forth in order to actually make a decision even on some of the things that were going on. So I'm sure that brought you into kind of the data mindset that I think you have, or at least I perceive you have anyway. But before we go that direction, how long have you been into cryptocurrency, and are you into a variety or just XRP?
Well, in September 2017, let me back up a little bit. In 1999, I started my first internet business. So I left public service. I decided to go out on my own, and I started an internet business, and I ran that for about 10 years. Basically semi-retired. I made enough money from that to semi-retire in 2008, 2009. I had always been involved in the investment world, going back to starting in my first stock purchase when I was 16 years old. So I've always been involved in the markets, loved the markets. And then in 2008, 2009, after I had semi-retired from the internet business, I took up investing again, and I really did some deep dive into what makes the market run, what is going on with the market. Taking a look at the structure of the market, supply, demand, volatility. I mean, I dove deep into market internals and what causes the market to go up, what causes the market to go down. Because of my internet business background, I probably should have paid a little bit more attention to cryptocurrency, but I didn't. In September of 2017, I was visiting my son in Washington, D.C., before we had purchased a property there. And it was just afterwards. And we were discussing cryptocurrencies. He said, "Dad, you got to look at this. This is going to be the next big thing." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "It's Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies." And I said, "I heard about Bitcoin a little bit. And the only thing I kind of heard about, of course, I didn't do any research whatsoever, was that it was a scam." And so I said, "Well, let me look at it," because I was kind of looking for another opportunity. I had gotten kind of bored being semi-retired at that point. And I said, "Let me take a look at it." So I went through CoinMarketCap's list of 100 cryptocurrencies, just the first page. Went through each and every single cryptocurrency that was listed there, went to the website, did a search on their white papers, read the white papers. If they had a phone number, if the project had a phone number on the website, I called them, I tried to get some information. And I went through every single one. And the only one that at that time in September 2017, it was really tackling a very large problem that needed to be solved. And they had an opportunity, I think, to solve that problem. They were well positioned to be able to do it. Was Ripple using XRP as a settlement, cross-border settlement token. And at that point, I decided to invest in XRP. And I've been investing in XRP ever since. And it's the only one I'm currently. And I do have a couple of Bitcoin, but my wife usually uses it for trading purposes. That's about it.
That makes you a specialist in XRP in that case, that's for sure. That being said, of course, I have to ask you, how in the world did you come up with the name Cryptopolis? That's a unique name, you have to admit.
It is. And I was actually kind of surprised that it was available both on YouTube and on Twitter, although there is another Cryptopolis on Twitter who's captured the name, but they haven't used their account in a very, very, very long time. On Twitter, it's Cryptopolis _ X. That's my Twitter handle. There's a movie that was back in the 1920s called Metropolis. And it was a very futuristic type of movie. And they had robots and they had escalators and they had flying machines in the city. And this was done in the 1920s. It was very, very futuristic looking. And I said, wow, you know what? That's really cool. And I'm thinking about cryptocurrencies. I'm thinking there's going to be eventually a city in the future in which DLT and XRP and other cryptocurrencies are probably going to rule the entire city. And it's going to be a very futuristic place. And so I said, well, I'm going to create the future city of the future, and I'm going to call it Cryptopolis. And when I did, I appointed myself mayor.
Well, count me to be on the board then.
That's right.
I think I said the county commissioner's board, the city commissioner's board, anyway.
The city of the future encompasses the entire universe. So I'm sure there's plenty of spots open for you, Chris.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. I truly am. You know, as moving into some more in-depth stuff, I constantly I'm seeing the reports and hearing this, and I don't want to get into conspiracies. I just want to look at facts and data. But we seem to, due to all kinds of indicators, be headed toward a very strong recession very soon. Now, that is only identified to me by the fact that we are dropping interest rates. It's mirroring a lot of what happened in 2008 and 2009. Actually, though, with heavier consequences than we had even then. As an example, and I'm just wanting to kind of kick off the conversation here, as an example, in 2008 and 2009, the Fed still had, I think, the interest rate around 5%. So they had some ammunition in the barrel that they could help that recession recover. But we're now at 1.75 or maybe less. So the Fed doesn't have their ammunition. They don't have the ammunition for recovery. And it may go down to 0% soon. What is your opinion there? And if that were the case in 2020, how does that affect XRP?
That's a loaded question there, Chris.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the storm is brewing, certainly. One of the things that we saw over the summer was an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve means that the shorter end of the yield curve is higher than the longer end of the yield curve. And that happened over the summer. And every single time since, I believe it's 1960s, it has always predicted a recession. And we have since corrected that inverted yield curve, but that's the same pattern that has happened every time since 1960. We go into an inverted yield curve, we start to come out of that inverted yield curve, and we get back to normal rates on the yield curve. Within the next quarter or two quarters, we go into a recession. That is kind of the trigger for the next recession. Now, we don't know, you know, how long this recession is going to take place, how long it's going to last. But every recession since about the 1980s has always been a little bit longer the next time. So we had one in 1980 to 1982, just before Greenspan came out with his basically the moral hazard comment that he was going to inform the bond desks that he was going to lower interest rates ahead of the actual act. And that was unprecedented at the time. And when he did that, the bond desk responded by buying equities. And then ever since, so the current bull market that we're in really started in 1982 based on the Fed Reserve actions and comments. We had a recession then, just short. In, of course, we had 1987. We had a big crash of the market, probably the largest one-day decline. I think it was October 19th, 1987. I was actually trading at that time. I was trading options from March to October of that year. In fact, I had a big bet that the market was going to decline. But I didn't have the timing right. Alan Abelson, who is the editor of Barron's magazine, had written an article, his commentary for that week, stating that there was a retail investor who had bought $16,000 worth of put options in the market for late in the summer. And that was me. And it was probably a pretty big bet on my part because I was only making about $16,000 a year. So it was a year's worth of salary. But I was pretty certain that the market was going to go down after this moral hazard was entered into the market. The problem was that I had an expiration for September, and the market didn't go down till October, so I lost the entire bet. So timing is everything in life, right?
Absolutely.
But it was very interesting, though. The day of the crash, I called my broker to get some quote on some stocks, and he said, I could give you a number, but in 1 second or 2 seconds, it won't be at that price anymore because the market is just moving too fast. And then, you know, those days you had to actually pick up the phone, a landline, and call your broker to get a quote. We didn't have computers back then. And so after that, I was always very, very interested in stocks, and I just kept, you know, buying, you know, I kept looking at the market, analyzing the market, doing the supply demand formulas and algorithms that I had started to develop. And I've continuously improved on those over the years. And now I'm getting to the point now where, for example, this past week, we had 3 days in which the Dow declined about 250 points. And we just pinpointed it spot on. Just FYI for everybody, I'm the CEO of strongmarket.com, which does provide the algorithms and analysis that I've created over the past 40 years, really. And we provide those in that analysis to our clients. So I've been in the markets for a very long time, and I've kind of, so to make, I could actually go on for quite a while, but
you're doing fine.
So over the years we've had recessions. I mean, you couldn't call 1987. That was just a crash. Then we get into 2000s. Now we've had financial engineering in the markets, basically, right? You have financial engineering in the market. We know the Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates throughout this entire period, and they come into 2000. Technology stocks benefited from the printing of this money through the Federal Reserve, and they got to the point where they were very, very overheated. They were very, very, sharply advancing in the market to the point where it was a bubble. And then we had the dot-com crash of 2000, which was turned into a kind of a short recession. And then we got into the housing bubble, which was in 2008, 2009. And that was a little bit of a longer recession. So all of the recessions going from 1982 to 2000 to 2008 were a little bit longer period of time. And so we, myself and some of the analysts that I've talked to and I work with are really indicating that the next recession could be twice as long or maybe even longer than the 2008-2009 recession, lasting for 3 to 5 years even. And part of the reason for that is that one of the things that we're trying to decide at this point and try to analyze is whether or not the recession, which we know is coming based on the inverted yield curve, is going to be a deflationary recession or an inflationary recession. There's a lot of signs pointing to a deflationary recession. Number one, wages during this entire period of economic growth that the Federal Reserve says that we're having since 2008 have not kept up. And so you see a lot of push and a lot of, Democrats especially have indicated that, hey, we need to increase the minimum wage across the board. And I agree with that because they have not kept up with inflation and it has not kept up with the economic the turn higher. Now, a lot of people say, well, what economic turn higher? I mean, we have not really had I think a lot of people would disagree with the fact that we're better off now than we were in 2008. I don't know what your opinion on that is, but why don't you chime in before I continue?
Well, no, I don't think our condition is better. I see all the indications that we've already blown it before it hits. We fired off, like I say, we fired off all of our bullets, and we don't have many bullets left. Mm-hmm. It's also has to do with, and please carry on, but it all has to do with the fact you look at the world's money supply, for example. There's 90 plus billion, a trillion in the global money supply, but there's 216 trillion in the global debt. I mean, something's wrong there, and something's going to blow up. So that's my opinion anyway.
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why that you don't feel the effects of the economic boom that the president says we have, and this is not a political statement in any way, but there's enough people from the government and the president saying, hey, look, we're in an economic expansion period. Well, one of the reasons that you and I don't feel that, and most of the people that you and I know don't feel that, is because most of the economic expansion has taken place in the financial markets and not on Main Street. Yeah. And so we've got this, we've got a dilemma here, because when the Federal Reserve decided they were going to print more money to help the, to kind of relieve the crisis of 2008-2009 with the mortgage bubble and the CDO bubble, they printed that money, and their investors, okay, the people who come to their window to borrow money are institutions, and their banks, and their, and so that money, in contrast to what happened pre-1982, like during the Reagan era, Reagan had this phrase that he used called the trickle-down economy. Yeah. And his opinion was that, hey, if we cut interest rates, if we lower the tax rate for the wealthiest individuals, and we start to provide them with additional capital, well, that excess capital will go into production, will go into producing more goods and services. It will trickle down from the financial services arena down to Main Street. And so, and that did happen during the 1980s. The problem now is that we're printing all this money very, very cheaply. People can go to the Fed window and if they're creditworthy, you get a lot of money, which filters down into other financial firms, institutions, and hedge funds and pension funds. Well, they're taking that money and they're investing in equities. They're investing in financial assets. Nothing to do with production. They're not investing in a company. For example, Apple is borrowing money like crazy at these low interest rates in order to do stock buybacks. Now, you have to think about this, and there's a lot of companies that are doing that. You have to think about it. Their best use, their highest and best use of their capital, even borrowed capital, in their opinion, is to invest it in their own stock rather than in R&D, production of goods and services in the economy. Now, this is a very, very big problem. And so all of the capital, all of the economic expansion that we've seen over the last 10 years has remained within the financial system. And for the majority of people, if you're not in the financial system, you're not benefiting. Production, manufacturing, services, goods, research and development, all of those things that can, help people who were either maybe, unemployed after the 2008 financial crisis or needed to find a new career because a lot of the jobs that were available then are no longer available, really haven't felt that economic expansion. There's been less production. There's been less manufacturing startups. There's been, that's why we just haven't felt that. And wages have been low. Prices have been low generally for goods across the board. We haven't seen the target inflation that the Federal Reserve really wants to hit. Now, at one time, back in the early 90s, they were talking about a 3%, maybe 3.5% target rate for inflation. Well, after all of the money printing that they did from 2008 to 2014, we barely hit 2%, barely. I mean, there's a number of years that we only hit 1.7. We didn't hit 2%. And so so for the majority of people, they're not feeling the economic expansion. All of that is within the financial system. And so we've got inflation at the financial, in the financial area, in the financial system, and we've got deflation in Main Street. And so whether the question whether or not we're going to have an inflationary recession or a deflationary recession, we see what we see is a gap between the financial sector and Main Street. Huge gap. One's inflationary, one's deflationary. And we're not quite sure how that's going to end, but we don't think it's going to be a good one.
And at the same time, as you say, all we hear from Washington is how fabulous the economy is.
Yes.
And if the economy is so fabulous, why are they giving the banks trillions of dollars every day? It seems like they could, make their own money, because that's what they're in the business to do, right? Is to add loan money and make money back. That's not happening fast enough because the government's giving them lots of money right now. Why is it necessary?
Yeah, they want to give away money. It's strange because in order for them to stimulate the economy, their idea of stimulating the economy is to get people to go into debt. And that's it. They said, okay, we're going to give money away at low interest rates. People are going to use that money and they're going to spend it on something. They're going to go out and buy houses. They're going to buy cars. They're going to buy whatever they want. So on the Main Street level, there is a push to get you farther into debt. That's how they think they're going to stimulate the economy. I got a big problem with that. I mean, I think most people agree that the kind of debt that we had back in 2008 is probably not a good thing. And now, because interest rates are so low, the banks can use, this really kind of goes around here. There's the banks, the Federal Reserve lowers the interest rates. The banks have lower interest rates that they're promoting for purchasing a house, purchasing a car, taking out a unsecured line of credit or whatever they want to offer at a very low interest rate. That loan goes out to the consumer. The consumer goes out and buys things, which helps stimulate the economy. And then those repayments of those loans going back to the banks can now lend out again to somebody else at a lower interest rate. So it's almost like a pyramid scheme, really. Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, it's just they're just taking the same money and regurgitating it over and over again and continuing to lower rates in order to stimulate the economy based on debt rather than real savings or real productivity. I don't think it's going to end well. I don't want to. I mean, I don't want to look like it's a dire, terribly dire situation. I think there's probably, we could be in a recession for 3 to 5 years. I think things are going to get really tough. I think if we do have a deflationary recession, that means the prices of everything are probably going to go down on Main Street. And that gap that I talked about between the financial sector and Main Street is going to have to be closed somehow. With negative interest rates, banks are going to have a very, very tough time making money, even on loan products. So they're going to have to build more fees into the products that they do have for customers. But at some point, I believe the financial system is going to start to decline and meet Main Street. So my opinion right now is that we're going to have a deflationary recession. And one of the metrics that we're using to determine if it's a deflationary recession is interest rates. And as you mentioned earlier, interest rates across the world have been declining. And we have an issue in the United States because we have an inflow, capital inflow, of money because we are one of the few countries left in the world that have positive interest rates.
Well, we see right now, of course, the rise of consumer debt has been as, you know, it's spiked as high as it's been in, you know, many years. We're at the top of the pyramid because people were going to buy it, but they bought their homes, they bought their cars and so forth. And that's starting to slow off right now.
That's right. Yeah, the current level of debt in the United States, especially student debt and auto loans, are now above the level of 2008.
Right.
So everybody's looking for that catalyst of what's going to create the really pain points in the next recession. Then in 2008, it was the mortgage crisis and CDOs and those going worthless, basically. And now it's student debt and auto loans, very, very high levels, higher than it was in 2008.
Well, as I mentioned that it, maybe I'm not totally the expert in this for sure. And of course, we definitely agree that the housing market was, the housing bubble, so to speak, was burst back then. And now we're talking about the problems with derivatives. Is that tied together?
They are because with all of the money printing that not only the United States has done, but almost every single country in the world, especially the EU, Japan, UK, almost all of the, I would say just about every country in the G7 have all contributed to this derivative problem because of low interest rates. So you take the low interest rates and what I was just discussing was that all of the money printing is going to the financial services industry. And so they are now investing that into equities and derivatives and other financial instruments. It's not going into mainstream. So that's the build out of derivatives that we're seeing. And you know, one of the real areas of concern at this point is Deutsche Bank, very much following the Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. Decline that we saw in 2008, 2009. Now it's Deutsche Bank, who's also very, very similar in their trajectory. If you take a look at their stock chart, it's very, very similar. If you overlay Lehman Brothers' stock chart, very, very similar. And one of the pain point for Deutsche Bank is the amount of derivatives that they have and counterparty risk in the derivatives that they've issued.
And do you think Deutsche Bank is too big to fail?
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons that Mario Draghi left the ECB was because of the fact that he didn't want to bail out Deutsche Bank. So that he said, no, you know what, I see that one coming and I've had enough. People hate me now. They're going to really hate me when I have to bail out Deutsche Bank. And so he decided to retire. They brought in an economist, but a politician too, is Christine Lagarde, which we love. As far as the XRP community goes, we love her because she's mentioned Ripple a number of times in her talks. And so she's come in now to kind of soften the blow, I guess, of probably eventually, getting to the point where she's going to have to make the decision and to bail out Deutsche Bank. I'm pretty sure they're not going to let Deutsche Bank fail.
I would seriously doubt that. Yeah. Now, all that being said, now the trick question, David, is this: how does that affect XRP?
Well, we've got. So we talked about all of the money printing that's going on in the world, and how it's benefited the financial sector, has not benefited Main Street. The president has come out and said, we want lower interest rates. I mean, look at the ECB and in Eurozone, they have lower interest rates than we do. Why do we have higher interest rates? Well, the reason why that's an issue is because it makes our exports from the United States much more expensive, in other countries. And the big problem with the trade war right now is that all of the countries that want to compete in the in world trade are engineering lower currencies. So China is constantly devaluing their currency. You've got other countries that want to devalue their currency, but China's the big one because they are let me go back a little bit and kind of set the stage why this is happening now. Back in the 1980s, a lot of manufacturers found out that were in the United States found out that they could actually produce goods and services cheaper in other countries than the United States. And so there was this mass migration of manufacturing companies to other countries, cheaper labor costs, less regulations. They found that they could produce all of these goods and services in other countries. Well, for a while, those destination countries was South America. Eventually, China got wind of this kind of migration of manufacturers from the United States to other countries and said, hey, look, you come to China, you can come to China and manufacture your goods and services. And we have very cheap labor, cheaper than South America. And so a lot of manufacturers decided, okay, yeah, we'll set up in China. Yeah, that's cool. Until China decided to not play fair with them and basically take over the manufacturing of most of the manufacturers that went over there, put them out of business, and then take over the manufacturing facilities and start producing goods and services on their own using their own labor. And so the Chinese government became an owner in a manufacturing empire. And they were able to produce goods and services at a very cheap price and export them to the United States for massive profits. And that's why China has been able to increase their GDP year over year. I mean, in double digits in some years. Just absolutely incredible, an economic engine. There was a great book by Jane Jacobs called The Economy of Cities that was published, I'm not sure, 70s or 80s, early 80s, maybe late 70s. And when I was director of economic development for the city I lived in, that was one of the first books I read. And she said that if you really want to increase the economic power or economic, if you want to increase the your city's economic health, you need to be a net exporter of goods and services, not an importer. And that is true not only for the city, but it's also true for countries. And when manufacturing left the United States and it went to China, it gave them the power to manufacture these goods and services to become an economic power. They were exporting more than they were importing. And that is the real problem with what's going on today, is that they have been a net exporter. They had devalued the currency in order to stay competitive, in order to stay, to increase their economic power. And we've lost manufacturing. And that's why we've transitioned from a manufacturing production-based economy, where that trickle-down effect could actually have an impact on a true economy for the average American individual. And instead, it's gone into financial services. We don't have that manufacturing base anymore. That went to China. That's why their GDP has gone double digits in some years. And they have grown by leaps and bounds over the United States. So that sets the background to where we are right now, which is everybody's trying to devalue the currencies to be able to compete on a world trade situation. And so if their currency is lower than ours, they can export to us at a cheaper rate. If our interest rates are higher, if our dollar is higher because of those interest rates. And so what happens is if we have higher interest rates than China, if we can park money for people who invest on a worldwide basis, and we can give them a risk-free rate of return of 2.5% on a 10-year treasury note, then they're going to come in and they're going to park money here in U.S. dollars. And so we have a high, and that increases the level of the dollar. So that increases the attractiveness of the dollar, and the more dollars come in, the higher it goes. Well, that has not had the effect of leveling the playing field. We can't have a level playing field in the trade arena between China and the United States because our dollar is going up. They're trying to devalue theirs, and so their goods and services are cheaper in the United States. And that is the big, big issue. We've got financial services, they've got production. Somehow, the reason why this trade war is such a big deal is because there's no way we can influence their currency, but they can influence ours. In fact, they're a big buyer of our currency. They're a big buyer of our treasury notes and bonds. And so we've got this tug at, we've got this tug going back and forth between, and the president has come out and said, hey, look, these guys aren't playing fair. And he knows it. And just about everybody else who's looked into this knows it. But there's nothing that we can do about it. We can't stop them from devaluing their currency, making their products and services cheaper to export unless we raise tariffs. So we start putting taxes on those goods and services that are coming into the United States, effectively canceling out the devaluation that they're doing in their currency.
Well, then, will XRP level the playing field of those things you're speaking of right now? Or is XRP totally out of that particular loop and in its own world?
No, I think this is just my opinion because I don't have any concrete facts. Now, one of the issues as an XRP investor is that we are, number one, we're investing in a protocol. XRP is a protocol on the XRP ledger. And so the only information we have is data coming out of the XRP ledger. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like investing in email services or SMTP or ESTP back in the early 90s on the internet. You know, you might have some usage statistics, but if you could actually buy a piece of the email services and the SMTP protocol at that time, you do very, very well. Now you can see the growth over the years. You make a fortune. So this is the first time that you could actually buy a protocol in the new financial services sector in fintech based on utility and usage across the world. But the problem is the XRP ledger doesn't put out press releases saying, hey guys, guess what? We just, we just opened up a new corridor. We just opened up this, we have great liquidity between Mexico and the Philippines right now. It's researchers in the XRP community who have to dig into the numbers and the network statistics of the XRP ledger in order to extract that data, analyze it, and then present it to XRP investors. Because we've got Ripple, which is a private company. They're not gonna tell us everything that they're gonna be doing on the XRP ledger. We've got R3, which is another company that's interested in using XRP in their payment flows. And then we've got SBI out of Japan, who has stated that they're going to be using XRP as well in their production flow and their payment and remittances businesses. But they're all private companies and we get very, very little information from them. In my opinion, though, it just makes sense that XRP, because of its scalability, it's very, very low transaction fees. It's quick and fast in settling transactions, especially in cross-border transactions. And the fact that it's a green, very low energy consumption ledger, that it's going to be used by central banks between each central bank, but within in those central banks to transact with each other, it's also going to open up a opportunity for financial technology services and remittance companies and banks to plug into those central banks that are using XRP for the cross-border flows and also use it as a settlement agent, settlement token for all of these financial services around the world. I see it as a opportunity to invest in the financial services of the future, really. And a lot of what I just said is really based on anecdotal data that we don't have any hard information about in news reports saying, hey, we're going to use XRP in our payment flows. We're not, you know, it's more like we see Brad Garlinghouse, the CEO, at the BIS, you know, on front stage, talking in front of Christine Lagarde, who was at that time with the IMF and with the head of the BIS and central bankers. We see him in photographs with the IMF and the World Bank. We got a video from Ripple stating that they're working with 50 plus central banks around the world, but no specifics. So it's a lot of this is anecdotal. We don't have any hard facts, but we hear about what they're doing and we try to put the pieces together the best we can to make an informed decision.
Well, I understand you just had a client return from a meeting with the IMF. Can you tell us anything? Are you at will to tell us anything that he learned while he was there?
He was a client. He was working on a project for the IMF and the BIS. In case people don't know, it's the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, and that they are basically the central bank for central banks. So they oversee most of the central banks in the world. He's a smart infrastructure engineer, and he works on a number of different projects. And one of the projects that he's working on that he told me that he gave me clearance to be able to talk about was a water filtration project. Now, the water filtration project is part of a larger push by central bankers. Now, he told me that he listened to the central bankers and he said he's listened to them and here's the major push and the major focus of the central banks around that he's been privy to is that they're focused on data. They want data, and they're also very, very focused on promoting digital inclusion and financial inclusion in Africa, in other parts of the world that have really been left out of the financial mainstream. So they're the unbanked, and most of the people have been out of the financial system. This is a huge opportunity that they feel for themselves is to include those, to really focus on projects of inclusion in the new financial system. So they are partnering with nonprofit corporate entities and organizations to give out laptops, cell phones to people all over the world that have not been traditionally included in the financial system. This is my opinion. Their end goal is that they want all the data they can possibly get on every transaction that's going to whatever region or country that they want to monitor in order to determine the liquidity needs for that region and to see if transactions are quickening or slowing down so they can determine where the pain points of the next recession are going to come from and which regions are going to be affected. So it's very, very interesting. He also invited me to Washington next time I'm down there to visit the IMF and the World Bank offices, which is kind of exciting.
Oh, absolutely. As long as you're able to ask questions of a few of the major individuals, it'll be even more fun for you. That's for sure.
Never know who we're going to run into. Yes, we'll see.
Well, you know, I don't mean to dumb this down. I know sometimes there's always this question that comes up, and that is, at least for people I talk with and around, and that is, we know that much of what Ripple is doing is waiting to build liquidity as to grow more than it has. A real world example being MoneyGram, which has asked them to grow faster, and Ripple saying, slow down, put the brakes on a little bit here. We have to build our liquidity more. Just to dumb it down, what exactly is liquidity? You know, we talk about it all the time, but what is it really?
Well, liquidity, If you can think of it as a let's say a price for this coffee cup, which actually has my name on it, by the way.
Hey,
a client of mine does pottery work, and he sent this to me as a gift, which was very, very nice.
That is cool.
I really do enjoy it. But let's see this cup. You don't have too many cups around, so this is kind of unique. It's customized and stuff like that. But if you just take a general idea of a cup, ceramic cup, and you put it into the marketplace, and let's say you put it on eBay, and you might have bids. And let's say you don't have the electronic bids, you're just taking bids. You say, okay, well, one person is offering 50 cents, and another person is offering $10. Well, there's a huge gap in between there of the lowest bid and the highest bid. And so eventually at some point, somebody's going to come in and say, well, look, you know, I'll bid two. Now the floor or two, and then the floor is raised. And then, you know, the $10 is still there. And then somebody said, well, I'll bid three. And the other person says, okay, well, I'm going to come down to like $9.50. And eventually you get down to the point where the highest bid and the lowest bid start to match. And you're getting closer to the actual price point of a good service. And what happens is in liquidity, and that's the kind of liquidity, you've got the 50 cent bid and you've got the $10 bid starting out. But as more and more people get involved in the market, you start to see those that spread between the high and low bid start to even out and come closer and closer together. If there's only one or two bidders, then you've got this huge gap. And so typically you would say that's an illiquid market because you can't sell it for what you really want. You've got a very, very wide discrepancy. Maybe this is not the exact the right analogy, but if there's more participants in the market, you're going to have a greater opportunity to translate this cup into cash. And that's what liquidity is. You want to be able to put this cup on a in any marketplace and try to get the fair value of it and convert it from a cup into cash in your hand. And that's liquidity. So the greater number of participants there are in the market that are interested in trading that particular item, the greater the liquidity, because you can put the item that you have in the market, you can get cash back for it, fiat back for it very, very quickly, and that's what creates liquidity.
How's Ripple planning to accomplish that?
Well, there's Miguel Valles from Ripple has been in charge of their markets and building liquidity across the world. And their strategy has been to create as many trading pairs for XRP as possible. And he's been very, very successful in doing that. When I first started back in September 2017, as I mentioned, getting involved in XRP, I had to buy Bitcoin in order to convert and then convert it to XRP. I couldn't buy XRP directly using USD. Now there are exchanges all over the world where you can buy XRP with USD, you can buy it with a Mexican peso, you can buy it with a Philippine dollar, you can buy it with a Singapore dollar, you can buy it with you can convert it to just about, I think there's like anywhere between 130 and 160 currencies around the world that people can use in order to purchase XRP directly. And so that is their goal. They want to be able to not only be able to buy XRP with currency, any currency in the world, but also to sell XRP into any other currency or fiat in the world as well. And they're working towards that goal, and that's going to create the liquidity that they need in order to really be ubiquitous in the financial sector when it comes to cross-border payments. Now, there's a little bit of misinformation though about liquidity for XRP. Now, obviously, in the corridors in which there's not a lot of transactions taking place, and one of the reasons why Ripple has focused on those corridors first is because there's a lot of inefficiencies and illiquidity in those corridors. And so typically the FX spreads, the spread between the two fiats, let's say we're going from Mexico to the Philippines, The spread on those is very wide because there's not a lot of transactions taking place. And so they focused on that corridor and a couple of other smaller corridors first in order to see if they can tighten up those spreads between the two currencies. And they've been successful doing that with MoneyGram. and then they can eventually go into the larger corridors where they have a lot more liquidity, for example, the US dollar and the euro, where the spreads are very, very tight already. And so they're trying, and now if they can spread to that point, they can say, okay, not only can we provide the same spread, but we're also going to give you a lot more information about that transaction. So we're going to tell you exactly what the cost is. We're going to lock in for you. And we're going to tell you exactly who your trading partner is. And we're going to give you end-to-end point confirmations of the transfer of those funds. And so at that point, I believe that they have the liquidity available to the point where XRP from fiat to fiat, with XRP in the middle of the transaction, is available nearly in every currency in the world. The issue, I think, for them expanding the use of XRP is legislation in the country that they want to be able to do business with. And we've seen some legislation pass already in Japan, for example, and in Thailand, and I believe Singapore, but I'm not sure on that. And we're just waiting now for the United States. The UK has been kind of a leader in passing legislation and also kind of categorizing tokens. So the UK, I can't remember the name of the agency, but the agency that the FSA, the Financial Services agency in the UK, has categorized XRP as a utility token, cross-border payment. And I think that categorization is very, very important. There's a lot of countries around the world that haven't done that work yet. The United States being one of the major players that has not done that work yet. And so that's kind of, I think the liquidity has been building. So we do have the ability to convert XRP to just about any currency in the world. The issue and the lack of adoption is coming from the legislative side. So we need that clarity from the legislation. There's also a very, very big issue with custody. This is something that has just, amazed me, is that the kind of custody that we're talking about for XRP is like, I mean, it's the same thing as like early 1900s and late 1880s, where you had companies that were at, if you bought a share of a stock in a company in the 1800s, you got a stack of certificates that you had to actually stick in your own safe. Well, you think about, fires, theft, all the other things that could take place that is a risk of holding on to those stock certificates. Is the same thing that we're doing now with cryptocurrencies. We're putting them on Ledger Nano S's. We're putting on cool wallets. We're putting on hard wallets, these cold storage wallets that we put in our desk in a safe in a bank vault or whatever wherever we store them. It's the same thing. And so that is a huge issue. I think before we get adoption, we need an institutional custody solution similar to what the DTCC is doing for custodying of securities. Now, the DTCC, which is the Depository Trust and Custody Corporation, DTCC, you guys can look it up, they custody $54 trillion worth of securities for 131 countries, including the United States. When you and I buy a security, we buy a share of Apple, for example, we don't get that certificate in the mail, but a chair and stick it in our safe. It's custodied by the DTCC, and so that solution has been around for many, many years, going back to the 50s and 60s. We're talking about providing that same kind of custody for cryptocurrencies. And when that happens and we get the legislation, this marketplace is going to take off, I think, in a very, very big way.
And that will make Ledger Nanos obsolete.
Yeah, hopefully Ledger, shout out to Ledger. I love their product. I have the product and I love it. And, I couldn't custody my own cryptocurrencies without it. But their business model better change with the times, because if they haven't seen it already, and I'm sure they have, is that institutional custody solutions are going to basically put that product on the shelf someplace and out of business.
The businesses have to change with the times.
That's true. Everything changes. The only constant is change.
I love that statement. I truly do. In the last few minutes that we have left here today, David, I am going to ask you the ultimate question. What do you think the ultimate value of XRP will be? And do you have any estimate of when that will happen?
Oh, boy. It's a loaded question.
I told you they're going to hold you to the line here.
Well, when I, in September 2017, when I looked at that coin market cap list and I went through all the first page of the 100 cryptocurrencies, and I picked XRP because they were solving the XRP was going to solve a very large problem. If Ripple's plan for the use of XRP in cross-border payments is going to come to fruition. I did a little calculation on the back of my napkin, calculation, so to speak. And I said, if they took, and I can't remember the number of trillions of dollars that SWIFT at that time was transacting in cross-border payments was settling. But at that time, I said, if they took just 5% of SWIFT's business on a daily basis, and people started using, banks and financial institutions started using XRP and Ripple solution instead of SWIFT, the price had to be at $1,000. And the reason why I did the one of the calculations, one of the assumptions, I guess, I made in that calculation was the fact that I took the number of transactions that were taking place across SWIFT's network on a daily basis, and I said how much of the liquidity out of XRP would need to be taken at the current price, and it was just way too high. They'd have to take out, almost the entire, they'd have to take out 100 billion XRP in order to settle the transactions that they had.
Only one series of transactions.
Yeah, exactly. So they'd have to take every XRP that was available on the XRP ledger in order to perform those transactions. Well, that's not going to happen at 23 cents. And so I said, well, in order to take 5% of Swiss business, what does the price of XRP have to be in order to use, let's say, 5% or 10, not even 5% of the liquidity or the available number of XRP that are available in the marketplace at any one time? And I said, okay, if in order to do that, the price has to be about $1,000. As far as when that's going to happen, that's my long-term goal. I mean, I said anywhere between 5 and 10 years, and that was in 2017. So that takes us out to 2027, which now is only, 7 years away.
7 years, yeah.
Yeah. So anything goes between, our current price, which is still at 23 cents, to $1,000 in, 7 years from now, is an appreciation that is quite amazing, actually.
Yes.
The big problem that a lot of people have is valuing cryptocurrencies. They still don't know how to do it. We still don't know how to do it because this is such a new digital asset, this new asset class. There aren't very many good valuation models. Market capitalization was kind of picked up from the stock market and the financial markets and applied to or kind of stuck on top of digital assets. And that's a horrible model, in my opinion. There's a new website called Coin Fair Value, I think it is.
I'm just about to ask you about that one. Yes.
Yeah. I believe it's Coin Fair Value. Let me just.
Yes, that's what.
Okay. And so they're using the quantity theory of money as their valuation model and using PE ratios. I think it's interesting. I think it's a step forward in the way that we value cryptocurrencies. I think there's probably still some work to be done on that. Susan Athey wrote a report, I believe it was in June or July of 2018, offering a valuation model. Susan Athey is on the board of directors for Ripple. She had an interesting valuation model. I think that we, as soon as legislation passes, we have custody, we're going to get a lot more institutional, traditional stock market institutional interest in cryptocurrencies. And we're going to get some very, very smart people who have done valuation models in the stock market for derivatives and for stocks and options and futures contracts, and boards and swaps and everything else to work on this issue. And we're going to get some really interesting stuff. So between now, I would say in 7 years, we've got probably, from where we are now to 7 years, about $1,000 valuation, in my opinion, for XRP. And so the price can fluctuate anywhere in between there. I have no idea, but I'm going to give it about 7 more years and $1,000.
An amazing prediction. And we are at November the 23rd, 2019. I'm time stamping this particular broadcast. So there you go. And Cryptopolis has put his hat in the ring. So that's fantastic. David, I have so many more questions to ask, but obviously we're out of time and I don't want to abuse your time as well. I appreciate you so much for taking your time and to share your knowledge, and the value that you have to the community is absolutely unlimited. So thank you very much for being a part of the community in that way and being able to share your knowledge with so many people that really, really need to know. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that very much, Chris. And thank you for what you're doing. I think it's your website is absolutely fantastic. I will certainly be a proponent and someone who will mention you as often as I can to all my friends and to anyone who is interested in getting the very best in news and up-to-date information on XRP.
That's very kind of you. Thank you so much, David. And thanks for being on again. All right. Okay. Now, there you go. We have some interesting folks on, but when you dig down deep, you really get some knowledge that is important to your understanding of all the processes that go to make XRP a valuable part of the world economy, or the future world economy. But as you can see, it's part of the world, our global economy, even right now. So my great thanks to Cryptopolis for being a part of this XRP Army News podcast. And until next time, remember to invest, but listen and learn as well. Thanks. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.